Welcome, Graham.
Good day, Mel. It's great to be here.
Graham, why don't we just start off with talking about bees and bumblebees in particular? Can you tell us about the different types and the variation within each species and things like that?
Sure. In this part of the world, and I'm speaking around the Rocky Mountain Biological Laboratory, there's about 14 or 15 species of bumblebees, and they're recognizable from other species because they tend to be largish and quite hairy. And the hair can be different colors, white or yellow or orange or red or black, and different species of bumblebees have these colors in different combinations. So if you learn the coloration for a particular species, you can identify them on that basis. They have interesting biology, and goes pretty much like this, that in the fall, bumblebee colonies turn to production of new queens and new males, and they mate. And then those freshly mated queens will find a hole in the ground that suits them for overwintering. So they'll spend the winter in the ground under all that snow, and the snow melts, and the queen will emerge. They're already mated, so that's already done. So they'll fly around, and they'll find a suitable hole in the ground for nesting. And you can see them flying around investigating holes. They'll fly quite low, and you'll see them land, walk into a hole, and sometimes walk straight out again. And presumably, they're checking out the decor, and when they find something that suits, they'll set up home. And they do that by building little cells, and in these cells they lay eggs, and they provision those eggs with a mixture of pollen and nectar, and the eggs hatch and the larvae feed on the nectar of pollen, and eventually they emerge as the first brood of worker bees, and those worker bees start to take over the role of foraging that up till then the queen has been performing, and then the queen forages less and less and just turns her activities just to laying eggs. So the workers take over. The first brood of workers tend to be fairly small, and then as time goes on you get slightly increasing size of workers, so you do get a gradation in size amongst the workers. This will proceed through the summer for a month or two, and then as the flowers start to wane, the bumblebees colonies turn their attention to producing the reproductives again. They produce new males, new queens, and all the males do is mate. And it's only the queens that survive the winter. All the other individuals simply die off.
So you'll have a queen. I know I've seen some bees out there that look like they're 3/4 of an inch long or even an inch sometimes. And then what, you will have workers that are about half that size to begin with?
Yes, typically the queens are relatively large, and there's one species around here that has a great name. It's Bombus nevadensis, and it's the biggest one. The queens there are a good inch long, and they weigh often a bit over a gram. Workers are about half that size, and the males are somewhere in between.
And then you said that there are also bees of different sizes as well, and how small are, let's say, the smallest bees that we have around here?
Okay, the range in size would be from queens of about an inch long down to queens that are only about a half inch, maybe even less, with a range in weights from over a gram for the biggest ones down to about a half a gram for the smallest ones. And correlated with that difference in size is also a difference in proboscis length, or sometimes people talk about it as a tongue, but it's not a real tongue, better termed a proboscis. That's what they use for getting the nectar, and the individuals with the long tongues or proboscises can reach nectar in flowers that have greater flower depth or longer corollas. And you tend to then to find individuals with the longer tongues feeding on the longer corolla flowers, and likewise species that have longer tongues feeding on the plant species that have the longer corollas.
So, for instance, I guess the longest tongue bees will go ahead and go after flowers like columbine with really long spurs. And where do the medium tongue bees go, and where do the shortest tongue bees go?
Okay, well, the columbines actually have corollas that are too long for any of the bumblebees to reach the nectar legitimately. That there is one species that's very interesting called Bombus occidentalis that occurs around here. It has quite a short tongue, but it's blessed with very strong mandibles, and it's able to bite holes in the corollas of plant with flowers like columbines, and hence gain access to nectar that it otherwise wouldn't be able to get to. But the bumblebees that have regular long tongues, they visit flowers like larkspur or monk's hood. The medium tongue species visit plants like Metensia or Agastache or Lonicera.
For our listening audience out there, Agastache is a mint called giant hyssop, and Lonicera is bush honeysuckle.
The short tongue species will visit things like the composites, Helianthella, Wyethia, Helidium, those kinds of plants.
That is aspen, sunflower, mule's ears, and sneezeweed. Now, you mentioned, I think, to me at one point that the Occidentalis, what do they call that, the Western bumblebee, seems to be going down in numbers and is generating concern among pollination biologists. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that particular species has declined throughout its range to the point of being locally extinct in much of the Western U.S. in places like California. There are many places there where it can no longer be found, where it was once quite abundant. It seems to have declined some also around this part of the world, though not to the same degree.
What about other different types of bees? Are there any parasitic bees around here?
There are two species of parasitic bees. We sometimes call them cuckoo bees because their biology is very similar to the birds, the cuckoo birds, in that the females will fly around early in the spring, and they're not looking for their own homes to make. They're looking for pre-existing homes that have already been set up by other bumblebees. And when they find them, they'll walk in and they'll start laying their own eggs in the nest of their hosts. And that way the hosts, just like the host cuckoo, raises the young of the parasitic bee as opposed to raising its own young.
Now, those kind of bees, are you saying then there are regular bumblebees that will actually go ahead and prepare a hole but not lay the eggs? And so it gives the cuckoos a short period of time to go ahead and go in there and find empty cells to lay their eggs in?
Well, basically, yes. The host bee would continue to have some cells and some eggs, so it's not that the cuckoo completely replaces the reproduction of the host. But the parasitic bee is able to get quite a lot of its own eggs into the host nest, and hence the host raises quite a lot of parasitic bees as if it were her own.
And are those young then emitting chemicals so that the parents are fooled into thinking it's their own bees that they're raising, or what?
I believe so. Haven't been a lot of studies done of that, but it's clear that these parasitic bees have various mechanisms for circumventing the mechanisms that the host might have to ward off the parasitic bees. It's probably a bit like cuckoo birds. It always amazes me to see parent birds feeding offspring that obviously aren't their own. And so presumably in that world of cuckoo birds, the cuckoos have found ways of making the host think they're feeding their own young. And I think the same must be true in these bumblebees.
Now, the bumblebees are not only going after nectar, but they're also going after pollen. Is that correct? Or is there some variation among bees about exactly what they're trying to get out of flowers?
Depends on where you are. Around here, what you see is mostly nectar collecting behavior. The bumblebees, it turns out, pick up pollen mostly incidentally to that nectar collection. They collect pollen on their hair, and every so often they'll stop, and you can see them do this. They'll stop and they'll groom that pollen off with their legs, and they'll pack the pollen then into these little baskets called corbiculae on their hind legs and to carry it off to their nests. They need the pollen. The pollen provides them with their protein. Nectar is basically just sugar and water, so it provides really just the energy. But the energy must presumably be in the shorter supply because that's what they devote most of their time to. They seem able to get enough pollen to provide the protein they need with a kind of a small amount of effort.
So you're saying that a lot of the bees just collect pollen incidentally, but then aren't there some bees that do something called buzz pollination?
There are some bees that do buzz pollination. Indeed, some bumblebees do that, and those bees are deliberately collecting pollen at the time. And perhaps I shouldn't have misled by suggesting that nectar collection is really the only thing that bumblebees are doing. There are some times when bumblebees are devoting all their time to collecting pollen as opposed to collecting nectar, and there are some plants that are particularly important in that regard. And this, it turns out, is important in another context, namely that of crop pollination. The crop, the tomato, that so many people, myself not included, like to eat, is a plant that is buzz pollinated, which means the pollen is located down in these hollow tubes, and to remove the pollen, the bee has to actually vibrate the anthers. And it takes a large bee to do that, and bumblebees, being large, are able to do that quite well, and that's why the people who grow tomatoes like to bring artificially domiciled colonies of bumblebees into their greenhouses to perform that pollination, because otherwise to do it by hand is quite time consuming.
I think I've actually remembered at least once hearing a bee doing an extremely strong buzz and then realizing that I was looking down and seeing this bee actually doing that buzz pollination, extracting pollen out of one of those flowers. Now, your research about 30 years ago is somehow connected with the research that you're doing now. I know you were gone for several decades in between. Why don't you tell us about what you were doing about 30 years ago and how it connects with what you're doing today?
Okay, well, 30 years ago, my main interest was in the foraging behavior of the bumblebees and trying to explain that, and also with patterns of coevolution between the bumblebees and the plants. And these patterns include one I've already mentioned, which is a relationship between the corolla length of the flower and the proboscis length of the bee, but there are others as well. It turns out, for example, that the rate of nectar production per flower is correlated with the size of the bumblebees. Those patterns I was and still am interested in explaining. Now, the work I did in surveying bumblebees in 1974 was not quite related to that, but that's what gave me the excuse to come back in 2007. And having come back, I rediscovered how interesting bumblebees are and how interesting the plants are. And so I've rekindled my interest in the foraging of the bees and how that's related to the coevolution with the plants. So my research right now is focused once again on those things. And what I hope to do is be able to use understanding of foraging behavior as a kind of mechanistic means to then understand the patterns of coevolution of the plants and the bumblebee pollinators, and also the patterns of community structure amongst the bumblebees. Why are there so many species, and why do we see the particular patterns we do in terms of differences in proboscis length and differences in body size?
So you think that's connected to the diversity of wildflowers and seasonality of these wildflowers that allow such diversity of bumblebees?
Oh, absolutely. But my focus will be, I think, primarily on trying to understand things from the bumblebee perspective, at least initially, and then maybe a bit later on try to deal with the plants.
Now, you mentioned there's been a change since 30 years ago from today, and you've said the bees are actually starting to forage much higher, and you mentioned that the plants are not necessarily following. Is that correct?
Yes. In comparing the 1974 surveys with the 2007 similar surveys, and I should say that we've tried as much as possible, as much as my 33-year-old memory would allow, to carry out the 2007 surveys in exactly the same places as the 1974 ones, and hopefully we did a good job of that. But what we found is that there's been some movement of the bumblebees up in elevation. It looks like they've moved up over that 33-year period by about 200 metres. And there's some movement of the plants, but not as much, and we speculate that the plants have a harder time moving in response to the changing climate, because they can't move by flying as the bumblebees do. They can only move by dispersing seeds, which then grow into new plants, which disperse seeds some more, and so on. So the plant dispersal is a much slower process, and we think that's the reason why we just haven't seen it occur as much as we've seen the bumblebees move. We have, however, seen a big change in terms of seasonality. The plants are blooming earlier now than they were 33 years ago, and that's interesting because the bumblebees seem not to have changed in that regard. So there's a growing mismatch between the flowering of the plants and when the bumblebees are active, And as a result of that, we think we're seeing reduced reproduction by the bumblebees. So we're bound to see over time, I think, a cascading effect where eventually the plants are going to have to pack up their bags and move because the climate is changing, and it's changing dramatically. And then the bumblebees will be in a situation where they have even fewer plants to feed on, and then they will decline rather precipitously, I think.
And I guess the other thing, too, is that plants can't necessarily move. They might try to go up further up a mountain, but if the soil isn't right, they simply aren't going to do that. They'll die out. So, as you say, that could really spell disruption for the bees. I think you mentioned that some of the plants, before when we were talking about this, which have limited distributions, show absolutely no movement. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's one of the things that's particularly puzzled me. There's a few plant species around here that you'd think would be perfect candidates for observing the effects of climate change. They're plants that back in 1974 were present and had quite narrow elevational ranges at that point in time. And they're plants like Polymonium foliosissimum and Linaria vulgaris, Agastache urticifolia. Those are plants that, like I said, were around 33 years ago. They occurred in a small number of places within a narrow elevational band, and 33 years later, they're still in exactly the same place. They haven't moved at all.
That's very interesting. It sounds like you were talking about, let me see, the first one was Skyrocket Polymonium. Then the second species was a really pernicious weed around here, isn't it? Butter and eggs. And then the third one is giant hyssop. I think it's the largest mint we have around here. And you're saying that none of them have changed their limited ranges at all.
Yes, that's correct. They just don't seem to have changed at all. They've changed a bit in a local abundance where they were occurring, but they're still occurring in the same places.
Can you contrast regular honeybees with bumblebees? I think a lot of people do see regular honeybees. Do they have a very different agenda from bumblebees, and how different are their lifestyles?
Well, it's interesting. So often I mention to people that I study bees, and of course everybody's heard about honeybees and has heard about the various things happening to the demise of honeybees. And so I tend to get questions about honeybees rather than questions about bumblebees. But as I point out to people who ask these questions, you have to realize that in the world out there, there are probably some 20,000 species of bees. A small proportion of those bees belong to the family Apidae. And that family includes the honeybee and includes the bumblebees. And the other 19 or so thousand bees out there are really very, very different and not well understood. The honeybee is unique. It's one species that we humans discovered a long time ago we could domesticate. We could encourage it to occupy artificial domiciles. And we've learnt that we could harvest then the honey that those bee colonies produce, and for many people who have that on their toast for breakfast, that's where it comes from. We also discovered that honeybees do a great job of pollinating many of the crops that are important to us humans, and for that reason, honeybees are grown and cultivated and moved around the place to perform crop pollination. And that may actually be part of their problem right now, in that honeybees are moved around by commercial beekeepers a lot more than they used to be. And as a result, any kind of a disease or illness that a bee colony gets isn't just localized like it might have once been, but now has the opportunity to spread throughout the rest of the world even. So diseases amongst honeybees spread a lot more than they used to, and I think that's got a lot to do with issues of colony collapse that have been occurring of late.
I've also been told that when you force honeybees to go ahead and simply pollinate and get nectar from just one sort of crop plant, it's almost like sort of being forced to eat at McDonald's. There just isn't enough enrichment in their diet so that they end up being weaker for doing so. Is that correct?
Well, yes, that's exactly right. Pollen, as I said a little while ago, is a source of protein, and therefore it's a very important component of the diet of any bee, honeybees included and bumblebees. And we know that different kinds of pollen differ enormously in terms of the proteins that they have in them and therefore their nutritional value. So, yes, one kind of pollen will be very different from another.
I guess it's a good reason to go ahead and give those honeybees, I guess, culinary vacations by releasing them to go ahead and just pollinate among a diversity of things in the wild.
Well, if you're talking about honeybees, I must say that I have a fairly jaundiced view of honeybees. Honeybees, to me, are one of the most obnoxious creatures in the world, and because of the impact they've had on native fauna and flora. And so I have very mixed feelings about honeybees. I'm happy to see them produce the honey we eat and pollinate our crops, but I wish they'd not go out in the wild and have deleterious impacts on native bees and native plants.
You feel that they've gone ahead and, in a sense, taken over or co-opted a certain amount of the wild plants from bumblebees and the other wild bees?
Well, yes, in some parts of the world, particularly Australia where I'm from, it's my experience to go out looking at flowers and looking for visitors to those flowers, including bees, and find that basically all you see are honeybees. So honeybees certainly have taken over. There are many studies showing that honeybees can account for removal of 90%+ of the available floral resources, nectar and pollen. There are other studies showing that this removal of resources has a negative impact on all kinds of animals that would otherwise use those resources. And also, honeybees, when they go wild, tend to occupy tree hollows. Tree hollows that would otherwise be the homes for a variety of other kinds of animals. Many birds use tree hollows, many mammals, and the honeybees take over those tree hollows and hence have a negative impact through that mechanism as well.
Well, thanks, Graham, for really telling us all about the bees today.
My pleasure. It's been great to be here, Mel.